Now, this evening, ladies and gentlemen, we are pleased to have with us our distinguished professor of this university. For those of you who know him as well as most of us, I think, do here tonight, I think I should fill in the formal part of his background. He was educated at King's College in Windsor, Nova Scotia, and attended King's College at Dalhousie University, where he obtained his Bachelor of Arts degree. He then went to Oxford and obtained his Bachelor of Arts and Master of Arts degree there. He was appointed in 1953 by the Carnegie Foundation to study the methods of university administration in Canada, the United States, Great Britain, and Europe, and spent considerable time in this task. He was formerly the housemaster, senior housemaster, and teacher of English at the Upper Canada College, and between 1943 and 45, the secretary of the Wartime Information Board at Ottawa. Between 1945 and 1947, the director of the Canadian Information Service, and in 1947 was appointed chief of the Information Division of the Department of External Affairs, Ottawa. Between 47 and 1953, he was at UBC here as a professor, Department of English, and the executive assistant to the president. And in 1953, appointed a dean and deputy to the president, in which position he now holds. I tell you that to fill in the formal record to all of those who know Dean Andrew. Of course, you're well aware that he has taken as his constituency more than the university, but has had a distinguished career in our community, welding town and gown in his interest, intense interest, in promoting and aiding the development of the humanities and the arts in the city of Vancouver. He has been, as you know, one of the active spirits behind the Vancouver Festival, and is always interested in the amenities and in the arts on this campus and everywhere where these subjects are paramount importance to us in the Western world. It's with great deal of pleasure I introduce to you a colleague and a very good friend of mine, Dean Jeffrey Andrew.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It always sounds rather odd when you hear a good friend of yours introduce you in these sort of stilted phrases, particularly when stilted phrases come hesitantly to his tongue. He's much better in the vernacular. It was, however, an extremely generous introduction, and I'm duly grateful. Now, there's one thing I should say, and that is that when I was invited to speak tonight, I took as my title the subject New Zealand from N to Z. And this is a straight crib from a book, a most entertaining book, on New Zealand social habits and customs written by a New Zealander, and I intended to give attribution to it. But somehow or other in the deal, that title got changed to New Zealand's Socialized Education, which of course doesn't mean a thing, and I have no responsibility for it. Mr. Nemetz has no responsibility for it. Mr. Sager, the secretary of the Institute, has no responsibility for it. And I can only assume that there's some printer who has social views that he wanted to get into the subject tonight. Now, I intend, as a matter of fact, to talk about New Zealand leading up to a statement on educational, higher educational principles, which applies, in my opinion, to New Zealand, but which I think has a somewhat wider reference, or at least I hope it has, and I'm going to submit it to you as having that wider reference. A year ago in July, I was invited to go to New Zealand as one of a committee of three to advise the New Zealand government on the future of their higher education. The other members of the committee were Sir David Hughes Parry, who was professor of law and director of the Institute of Legal Studies at the London School of Economics in the University of London, and former Vice Chancellor of the University of London. And the other member of the committee was Dr. Roy Harmon, a New Zealander who had got his first degree at the University of Auckland and had then gone to the University of London, where he got his Doctor of Science degree and had spent his life, active life, in the Colonial Sugar Company in Australia, headquarters Sydney, Australia, and had gone back to New Zealand to retire, but the New Zealand government was keeping him pretty busy on extracurricular activities of this kind. Now, we went there, and we were given these terms of reference by the government. The committee is asked to indicate ways in which the university system should be organized to ensure that the long-term pattern of development is in the best interests of the nation, and without limiting the broad scope of its reference, to inquire into such matters as, 1, the role of the university in the New Zealand community, 2, the number of young people for whom university education should be provided, and the standard of attainment considered desirable for those wishing to enter the universities, 3, the maintenance, extension, and coordination of university education and facilities, 4, recruitment, staffing, and conditions of employment in the universities, 5, the financial needs of university education and appropriate means of providing those needs, 6, and this is always the lovely statement in the terms of reference of a commission or a committee such as this, any other matters relevant to New Zealand education in New Zealand, university education in New Zealand. So that we had lots of scope for inquiry. Now, we assembled in Wellington on September the 7th, and I left for home on December the 10th. So in that interval of time, the three of us had what was to me the most interesting single assignment I've ever had in my lifetime, the assignment of trying to come to grips with the educational, the higher educational needs of a society, and to relate those needs to the well-being of the community. And it was a fascinating assignment for this reason, that New Zealand is a small country. Its population was variously estimated at that time by our academic colleagues there as being about 2,300,000, by the Board of Trade as being 2.5 million, roughly. And the rest of the population of New Zealand consisted of about 2 million cattle and about 40 million sheep. We spent the first 6 weeks reading about 140 briefs that were submitted in writing, and interviewing countless people, both town and gown, who had views on the universities and the well-being of the community. We then, having traveled about the country, came back to rest in Wellington, the capital, and we spent the next 7 weeks concluding our interviews with government officials and other persons whose goodwill would be necessary to carry any recommendations into effect, and then writing the report. And so the fascinating thing about it really was that in a little over 3 months, one had the assignment of trying to come to grips with the economic, social, educational problems of a nation, a nice, in this case, small nation, so that you could have the feeling of coming to grips with it, and then sitting down to write a report with a deadline, but also with the possibility of doing, relatively speaking, your best in meeting the deadline. Now, we were assisted in this task by two very able young New Zealanders, Professor Holmes, Professor of Economics at the University at Victoria University, Wellington, who was one of the secretaries of the committee, and Mr. Ross Rowley of the Department of Education, who was an extremely well-informed and able public servant, the other member, so that we had the best of advice, and we had an extraordinarily interesting time. Now, the University of New Zealand requires a little explanation before I get down to cases. New Zealand has four, what you might call university colleges, and two agricultural colleges, and they were, and up to the present time, are all tied together by a thing called the University of New Zealand, which gives degrees, but which is not a teaching institution and has no establishment, so to speak. The University of New Zealand consists really of a chancellor, a vice chancellor, a senate, a registrar, and some assistants and secretaries and staff. And this University of New Zealand had been in existence for some years, but prior to our going there, it was decided that the University of New Zealand, as such, had outlived its usefulness and should be disestablished. Now, this decision was based on the desirability of granting autonomy to the individual institutions. The process of what they called devolution of responsibility had gone on a fair way by the time we reached there. The reasons for disestablishing it really were that the Senate was an unwieldy piece of mechanism and was not capable of tying together the university colleges and bringing them to a cohesive program for the development of the islands. So that we arrived to find that that was the situation in existence, and that they had been pretty well committed to that line of action. Now, with 2,300,000 people, roughly, that's just a few hundred thousand larger than British Columbia. And in everything I say tonight, I would like you to keep in mind, if you would, a rough parallel between British Columbia and New Zealand. With 2,300,000 people, you have four major centers of population. In the North Island, and incidentally there's a great deal of rivalry between the North and South Island in New Zealand. In the North Island, the biggest center of population is the most northerly city, Auckland, a city of about 400,000. It's the bustling commercial capital of New Zealand. And it's a little, in Canadian terms, a little like Toronto, in that everybody else in the islands hates Auckland, But Auckland is pretty sure that it is the center of at least this particular empire. Auckland's a very attractive city. The whole of the islands are very attractive, and in particular, you never talk to any Aucklander without having the beauties of Rangitoto, a volcanic island in the harbor, pointed out to you. The second city on the North Island is Wellington, the capital. And Wellington is, I think, one of the windiest cities in the world. They don't really call it a blow until the wind gets up to about 70 miles an hour. I was walking along the street one day when the wind was about 80 miles an hour and had to duck because the, what they call a boot of a car, came whistling over, that had just been lifted off the car, and rolled down the street in front of us. And the paper that morning had advised all elderly people to stay off the streets. Now, Wellington, I suppose, has about 250,000 people and is on a perfectly magnificent, beautiful harbor. Those are the two main centers of population, and there's a good deal of rivalry between them. In the South Island, which was settled early and much more respectably in New Zealand terms than the North Island, Auckland was, in the early days, a center of for whaling fleets and escaped convicts. And the South Islanders, particularly the inhabitants of Christchurch and Dunedin, tend to look down their noses a bit at this upstart commercial area to this day. The two main centers in the South Island, Christchurch, which was settled by English Anglicans, is a lovely city, I think. It's built about a cathedral square in the English pattern, and the cathedral square really is most attractive. And it's got the most beautiful park inside a city, 1,000 acres in the heart of the city, Hagley Park. It had the most glorious showing of daffodils and narcissi that I've ever seen in the spring there. And the one thing that occurred to me at this point in comparison with Canada is this, that the English never mind expending their wealth on city beautification. They do enjoy that. Now, when you go down south to Dunedin, which was settled by the Scots and also is a center, a university center, the University of Otago, there, there's no money wasted on beautifying the city. But on the other hand, it was the first place to have an educational institution in New Zealand. And these differing virtues of the United Kingdom drew to my attention the extent to which we have been notably under Scottish influence in Canada rather than English. Now, the other thing that as we spent a week in each of these main centers, and then about 3 or 4 days in Lincoln, which is very near to Christchurch, where there's an agricultural college, Canterbury Agricultural College, and a few days in a place called Palmerston North, about 80 miles from Wellington, where there's another agricultural college, the Massey College. Having toured those places and having also had a few days off on the weekends to go and enjoy the New Zealand countryside at our leisure, we really had a fair knowledge of the geography of New Zealand. And I do commend to any of you who have the leisure to take a holiday tour, the thing I still want to do, having been there now once, is to go there by ship in a nice leisurely fashion. It will incidentally get me accustomed to the pace of life in New Zealand if I go there in that way rather than by plane, because life is more leisurely in every way than it is in this continent. Second thing I'd like to say in this context is that I think it's a fascination to any Canadian to go to New Zealand, because you feel an affinity with the New Zealanders, particularly when you start discussing Australia. New Zealanders too, vis-a-vis Australians, are extremely like Canadians vis-a-vis Americans. We're more solid, and we think, I'm talking from our point of view, respectable. That's another word for complacent. We're more conservative and less imaginative. We tend to look down our noses at their origins as being revolutionary, or in the case of New Zealand vis-a-vis Australia, I don't need to explain why they look down their noses there. But on the whole, we pride ourselves on being solid citizens rather than having any of these spectacular virtues. And this is one of the things that I think pleases a Canadian, because you think the New Zealanders are rather like us, only being Canadian. Well, we have a little more of this and that. Now, there are no nicer people or more hospitable people on earth. And also, I would like to draw attention to the particular points of pride of New Zealand, because I think this leads into some of the things I want to say in my short essay. All of this is merely a prelude to an essay. And that is that the things that they are really good at, they are in fact better at than we Canadians, than us Canadians. And these are, one, soldiering. There are no better soldiers anywhere in the world than New Zealanders. And as a matter of fact, most of us in Canada regard the Australians as being pretty good soldiers. Well, the New Zealander will admit that the Australian isn't bad, but he's a little soft. And the New Zealanders have this difference, as a New Zealander explained it to me himself, vis-a-vis an Australian. He said, you know, both New Zealanders and Australians like to get into a fight. But he said, the Australian, when he's knocked a man down, is just as likely to smile at him and help him up again. Not so the New Zealander. He'll go away with a rather wry smile on his face and rubbing his knuckles. They're a little more dour in a way than the Australians, as explained by the New Zealander himself. The second thing that they're awfully good at, as a matter of fact, they're the best in the world, in my opinion, at this, and that is playing rugger. And this is a very important matter in New Zealand. To belong to the National Rugger Committee is a mark of great distinction. And they play a very fine game, amateur game, incidentally. And amateur sport flourishes like nobody's business in New Zealand. And I've seen some of the most fascinating, good, hard, rigorous rugger games anywhere. Now, I know that there are one or two South Africans in the audience, and so I should say this, that the only people that the New Zealanders will confess may possibly be in the same league as them playing rugger are South Africans. The third thing they're awfully good at is mountain climbing. The fourth thing that they have, it's a kind of sport mixed with an industry, and that is aerial top dressing. They fly little aeroplanes up and down their narrow little valleys, fertilizing the whole country, because they've got to make the best use of what they've got. And this is a sporting activity that causes a few deaths a year, but I wouldn't be caught dead in this. That reminds me for all the world of what Leonard Brockington, during the war, once described as riding bareback on a butterfly. The point I want to make here is this, that anything with a really severe physical challenge, the New Zealanders take a dour delight in responding to. And they've produced a fine, resourceful, practical people in these particular areas and a lot more. Socially, of course, the thing they're very proud of is their race relations, their Maori relations. And despite the fact that that doesn't necessarily make its appeal to the whole population, New Zealanders, by and large, whether or not they know anything about their race relations with the Maoris, are proud of the repute that New Zealand has in the world community in its relationships with its native people. Now, on the other side of life, the non-physical, and I should just add this, that on the physical side, you never saw so many amenities. There's a racetrack at every crossroads, as far as one can gather, and tennis courts and golf courses and beaches, and the New Zealander loves his batch on a beach above most things. And they live an extremely active, alert, outdoor life, and their standard of physical fitness would, I imagine, be way beyond ours. On the cultural side of things, there are many, many more bookstores per head of population than in Canada or the United States. And I would think that there are also more authors per head of population than there are anywhere else in the English-speaking world. About half the population of New Zealand that I'd met had written a book, at least one. They really are a tremendously literate people and literary people. A second thing that impresses a visitor to any of their cities is the standard of their record shops. They don't have as much live music as North America or any country in Europe, but they really do enjoy their music and their literature at home, and their gardens. And of course, their gardens are fabulous, comparable with Victoria, or Portland, Oregon, to name some famous North American centers, not to mention Vancouver. Now, in all these areas of life, one finds a great deal to enjoy and to admire. But then a little, you come to one or two other conclusions, and one is that New Zealand is very remote, which is one reason for its literariness and its enjoyment of gardening and good music. It is also, in some respects, too homogeneous culturally, because almost everyone there, except for the about 160,000 Maoris, I think it is now, and they're increasing at a very rapid rate. There's a very interesting comparison, actually, because the Maoris in 1840, about, they may have had, the estimates range very widely in the Maori population from you can get almost any estimate you like. But the important fact is that from 1840 to 1896, the same thing happened to the Maoris as happened to the North American Indian. They were decimated by smallpox, tuberculosis, and social diseases of one kind and another, until they got down to about 60,000. And since then, with the development of preventive medicine and better health care, they're very rapidly on the increase now, with a population of 160,000. But apart from the Maoris, they're a very homogeneous people, and there's a good deal of intermarriage at two levels between the Maoris and the rest of the population. As one would expect, there's intermarriage at the lowest economic level, and there's also some intermarriage at the professional level. And the New Zealanders are, from the point of view of one who approves this, they're extremely sane and sensible in this area. But the other thing is that they're almost all, the rest of them are almost all English, and they culturally, they only basically know the English tradition, and in a sense they only know a part of it. They only know the county tradition, and they only know that a little late. So that there's a certain sameness. They don't know the metropolitan. They haven't got metropolitan areas like London, which England has. And so there's a certain sameness which makes for a certain dullness. And this is one place that reminded me how much, really, a country derives in its life from having a variety of peoples. And William Lyon Mackenzie King's old statement about unity through diversity meant a lot more to me in New Zealand, because I think we've derived a great deal of such life and vitality as we have in Canada from the intermingling of peoples that make up our population. So that I say, in New Zealand, there's a little too much cultural sameness to give themselves enough feeling of variety and diversity. And the last thing is that under the present welfare state in New Zealand, there is really too much economic sameness. If I can put it this way, almost 90% of the population lives between £1,000 income and £3,000. And this means that almost everybody lives very much the same in economic terms, and they live very much the same in cultural terms, and they're very far removed from other countries. So that a great many young New Zealanders want to get away. And that's the upshot of this. And this has a bearing on their educational system, and that's why I've elaborated it. Now, there are two other basic things I want to say before I come to the, so to speak, the punchline. This one is that the New Zealanders are an extremely egalitarian society. They pride them. Egalitarian instincts of the New Zealanders that he meets of all classes. They're friendly and very forthright, and they really think that they are, in a sense, more egalitarian than they are. Because I was deeply impressed with their egalitarians until a Royal Honours List came out while I was there, and I found that the whole society wasn't egalitarian, because this caused a great commotion. Everybody was terribly interested in that. Incidentally, I also discovered from that how lucky we are in Canada not to have honors, because this has increased the value of university honorary degrees. And has put the universities in the position of being distributing royal largesse, which has had certain advantages for universities. Now, with this egalitarian society, the New Zealanders in the early 30s had a total review of their elementary and secondary educational system. And a document that is very important in New Zealand, the Thomas Report, came out and recommended the implementation of social democracy in their elementary and secondary educational system. Prior to that, they had had an educational system at that, those levels of education that was very much based on the British system of private schools, public schools in the British sense, of grammar schools, good grammar schools that weren't so good, and technical schools. But in 1937, they came out for the comprehensive high school as the educational social instrument for the implementation of equality of educational opportunity. Now, they incorporated into this new system the old grammar schools, which still retain the characteristics of the best English grammar schools. Auckland Grammar School, for example, is a first-rate academic school. It isn't really a comprehensive high school in the Canadian sense, or in the American sense, or in the sense that the New Zealanders themselves talked about at this time of changing their educational system. And they still retain technical schools, which are in the process of becoming comprehensive high schools. Now, the purpose of the comprehensive high school in New Zealand was to allow everyone in this egalitarian society a really egalitarian approach to education. And they had five streams and have five streams in the high schools: the academic stream, the technical stream, the agricultural stream, the what you might call the domestic science stream, we'd call it home ec here, and clerical. Now, having put those streams into existence within the comprehensive high school, they then, and this is an outgrowth of their egalitarianism, they then demanded that people could go up any of those streams and still get to university. This was going to be open-ended, so that you had the a system in which the pressures of population and the same problem that we all have of inadequate number of well-trained teachers meant that these streams themselves tended, by virtue of the weight of numbers and the lack of teachers, to drag down the standards of their secondary education, and they were quite concerned about this. Now, in the meantime, they'd never had any examination since 1925 of their higher educational system. And their higher educational system, when we went there, suffered from two direct counter-pulls. Well, as a matter of fact, one might say three. On the one hand, the products of the schools were not as well-trained academically as the products of the old grammar schools had been. And the university population, which had tended to come at an earlier period from the grammar schools alone, and now came from the comprehensive high schools and the grammar schools, tended to have a much more variable standard. And as a matter of fact, the entrance standards, which are a little too complex for me to go into in detail here, the entrance standards, you could come in by various routes, three major routes. And the people who came through by the cheapest route, let's say up the technical course in the high school, and then switch at the end to the university program, these people represented a very variable quality from the people who had gone through the straight Auckland Grammar School route to the upper sixth and in. So that there was a serious lack of relationship between the high school system and the university system when we went there, and there still is. Now, that was one of the things that was tending to depress, or to want to depress, the university system. The second thing was that out of this social egalitarianism, combined with a kind of pioneer spirit that said that anybody should be entitled to an education, but it was up to him to get it, not up to his parents to assist much. Out of these two things, you had an enormous number of part-time students. In fact, 50% of the university population of New Zealand when we went there were part-time students. And of these part-time students, not more than 30% of the 50% part-time students ever got anywhere to speak of in an academic program. Less than 10% finished their academic program. And of those who finished, it took them somewhere between 8 and 10 years to do it. Now, this is an enormous drag on the vitality of the universities. But such is the feeling for the egalitarian spirit that they conceive to be behind this, that you're attacking a sacred cow there that is almost as sacred as rugby football. And you've got to be very careful about this. I got into a dreadful argument there with the head of their civil service commission, who laid it down as a primary principle that there was something about handling a full-time job and taking an engineering course or law or accountancy on top of this and getting married and handling the affairs of a family on top of that that brought out the best in the man. Now, he remained unconvinced when you pointed out that you can't stop the best 5% of people in any country from getting an education. You simply can't stop it, no matter how high hurdles you put in the way. But, I was moved to remark, it also seemed to me that trial by ordeal had been abandoned some time ago for good and sufficient reason. And this, I repeat this for this reason, that in New Zealand there's still a tremendously strong feeling that there's something pretty good about working for your education by degree, by degrees. And this has caused a lot of complications. Now, the universities, faced with these depressing influences on their standards, had themselves, in my opinion, recoiled in a way that didn't help the educational system much, because they recoiled into a kind of mock Oxford ivory tower attitude towards their job. And despite the fact that I am, I think, a loyal graduate of Oxford University, there's one thing I agreed with the chairman of this committee on, and that was that on the whole we thought that Oxford perhaps had had a pretty pernicious influence around the Commonwealth, in that not always do all of its best sons get to the farthest reaches of the Commonwealth, and some of them delight to prove how above standard they are by being rather punitive in their definition of standards. Now, there was definitely, in the universities, there were two strong pulls. And one was this depressing pull on standards, caused by the egalitarian tradition and by the rather declining standards of the high school education. And on the other hand, a definite feeling among the universities that the way to handle this was, so to speak, to widen the gulf between high school and university. And there was an elitist attitude on the part of the universities, in which they felt that if they moved in the direction of meeting the subordinate needs of society, they'd be dragged even farther away from the kind of standards they wanted to maintain. And this was a very difficult position for them to find themselves in. So that this was the background against which we had to try to write our report. And the thing that I want to do now is just to read the early part, just a few pages of this report, on the role of the university in the New Zealand community. And this is what all this has been leading up to, because this was a part of the report that I myself was particularly interested in. I feel actually that almost every place that I say New Zealand here, we could say British Columbia, or for that matter, Canada. And because it gives a point of view about the function of higher education in relation to the needs of learning and the needs of a community, I wanted to lead up to this. What role the universities should play in the New Zealand community will depend in large measure upon the kind of society New Zealand wants and is willing to pay for. We have received submissions from departments of government, professional groups, voluntary societies, as well as from the University of New Zealand and its constituent universities and agricultural colleges, all of which indicate that many New Zealanders want and feel that New Zealand must have a more diversified and more industrialized economy if it is to maintain its population at the present standard of living and, if possible, improve it. That they want a wider variety and a progressive improvement of social and professional services. And that they want to foster a better and deeper understanding of New Zealand's own life and problems in order to provide a more varied and more interesting life for the community. How much public support these representations have, we are not in a position to say. But if New Zealand does want and is willing to pay for a more developed economic, social, and cultural life, then the universities must play a much greater role in the New Zealand community and must be much better supported financially than they have been in the past. If, for example, New Zealand is to develop more secondary industry, then she will have to educate or import more chemical, physical, and biological scientists, more engineers, more chemical, building, and food technologists, more economists, and more people trained in the arts and skills of management. The worldwide demand for such persons is currently so great and is growing so rapidly that the opportunity to import them and the numbers required are limited. The alternative is to import and educate the teachers in these fields, and with their help and guidance, to develop the skills required in universities and or technological institutions. Even if the decision is made to educate the required personnel locally, there will be a further question to answer, namely, what part shall the universities and agricultural colleges play in the development of these new skills and emerging professions? This subject is explored in detail in a later chapter of the report. It's referred to here for the purpose of illustrating the fact that the role of the university in the community depends upon the kind of community being planned. A second example illustrates the concern which has been expressed to us for New Zealand's social development. If New Zealand wants to continue to supply her population with health, welfare, and public educational services of a high order, and to continue to improve them, then she must induce a sufficient number of the best qualified of her young people to offer and equip themselves for this work. At the moment, in common with other countries, New Zealand is trying to staff her schools and other public services from a low birth rate generation in order to cater for a very high birth rate generation. And this is brought about, again in common with other countries, a lowering of academic standards for entrance to some of the public services, notably teaching. We mention teaching specifically because the Department of Education has drawn public attention to the present critical shortage of teachers, and particularly to the shortage of those with full qualifications. The department is concerned, as are the teachers of New Zealand and the public, that the country's most valuable resource, its young people, shall not have their vision and skill limited by being educated by those whose own education is inadequate. With this in mind, the department, with the support of the teaching profession, is trying to stimulate as many as possible of those now taking primary as well as post-primary teacher training who have the requisite qualifications to pursue university studies. When the supply of those coming into teacher training who possess university entrance qualifications catches up with the demand, as it is expected to do in 4 or 5 years, the present demand for university programs of study will be much increased. Here again, the quality of excellence the public wants, and is willing to pay for in the training of those who educate their children and who perform other social services will affect the role of the university in the community. One further illustration may be offered. It has been represented to us that New Zealand should introduce into university studies, or develop to a higher level, more of those subjects which have a direct bearing on New Zealand's own life and problems, which are designed to foster the growth of national self-understanding and to increase delight in life. It is suggested to us that more attention should be paid at the universities, at the appropriate level, to New Zealand's own history, life and literature, the arts, with particular emphasis on design, economic problems, social organization, marine environment, soil science and forest problems, to name only some from very diverse fields. It is argued by those making the representations that such studies would widen the vision of promising students regarding the possibilities of life in New Zealand, and would strengthen their roots in the New Zealand environment before they go abroad, if they do go, with the result that more of them would have stronger incentives to return to fields of study into which they have already penetrated or in which they have already achieved some degree of authority. The purpose here again is to show the relationship between the university's role and the community's aspiration. If New Zealand wants to foster more and more advanced study of its own life and problems, then the universities will have to be equipped to carry out such study, much of it, at the more expensive graduate level. In all three of the illustrations given here, the university's role in the community will be vitally affected by the image the community has of its own economic, social, and cultural future, and by its view of the university's part in shaping that future. At the moment, New Zealand's attitude towards its universities and colleges is similar to that of most other young and developing countries, not far removed from a pioneer tradition, which is prepared to cater to the needs of today and tomorrow, but doubts the value of planning too far ahead, and which tends to prefer practice without theory. To say this is not to be critical of the pioneer tradition in its time and place, but to doubt whether the continuance of that tradition will longer serve New Zealand's needs in a world where scientific, social, and technological change have become the norm, and where planning ahead is as accepted a part of public policy as it is of personal policy. In keeping with this pioneer tradition, the universities of New Zealand are not widely regarded as having a primary responsibility for original investigation and research. They should stick to their teaching, it has been said. To say this, to advocate the separation of teaching from research, is to invite social and cultural, no less than scientific and technological, stagnation. Society, if it is to make advances, must have institutions in which teaching and research go hand in hand, in which students can come into contact with and become excited by the possibilities of research and its relation to human progress. The universities of New Zealand are aware of the need to combine teaching with research. And indeed, a certain amount of research is being carried on, despite heavy teaching loads, inadequate facilities, and little financial support. We could read BC there, too. A detailed discussion of New Zealand's research problems will be found in a separate chapter of this report. It is sufficient at this point to indicate that unless the university teaching staff are provided with the time, money, and facilities to think about the future of their society in relation to its past, to compare and relate the contributions of other cultures to those of their own, to investigate the nature of the physical world and to keep abreast of the investigations of others, they will not be in a position to serve their society as, in recent years, in most developing countries, they have been asked to serve it. The traditional view of the university in the British conception of higher education has undergone substantial modifications and adaptations in the 19th and 20th centuries, consequent upon the new social requirements which brought into being many of the civic universities in the United Kingdom, and the equivalent needs which prompted the development of similar institutions in the United States and throughout the Commonwealth. The monastic tradition in which the ancient universities were founded to prepare young men, quote, for church in service and for service in church and state, has had to accommodate itself to the idea of coeducation, among other things, and also to broaden its program of studies beyond the traditional disciplines of theology, law, art, science, and medicine, in order to provide the wider range of professional skills that the new societies require. Agricultural science, architecture, dentistry, education, engineering, forestry, home science, pharmacy, business administration, public administration, social work, and librarianship, to name only some. Those examples, incidentally, were taken from representations made to us in New Zealand. In addition to the increase in specifically professional studies, the 19th and 20th centuries have also seen a thorough overhauling of the traditional arts and science curriculum. A great enlargement in the area of general studies and an increased emphasis on liberal education, partly for its own sake and partly as the intellectual equipment of those who propose to follow a career in public service, politics, journalism, or teaching, rather than in one of the traditional professions. Paralleling the emphasis on liberal education and the renovation of the science curriculum, and related to both, there has developed a much greater emphasis on the responsibility of the universities for research, both pure and applied, in part as a service to society, and in part to invigorate both teaching and learning. There can be no doubt that the stimulus which research has given to university life has been in large measure responsible for the greatly increased contemporary recognition of the importance of the universities as centers of independent thought, as guardians of the accumulated culture of the past, as social and scientific laboratories for the accumulation of new knowledge, and as pilot plants for the experimental applications of new knowledge to the solution of economic, technological, social, and cultural problems. The need to maintain their independence has been widely accepted, even in new societies, even when, perhaps particularly when, as happens, they become centers of unpopular thought, because it is only in this way that society can have its accepted attitudes, values, and techniques challenged and changed if the challenge stands up to public scrutiny. Universities are looked to by contemporary societies to generate the seeds of speculative thought and new knowledge, to stimulate as well as to inform the young, to hold up both the image of the past and the possible shape of the future. And to do this effectively, they require a sense of community of their own, an environment within which special fields of knowledge can be developed without becoming mere fragmented specialisms, where knowledge itself can be humanized by daily contact in lecture halls, common rooms, and residences between scholars and students from diverse fields of study with differing approaches and objectives. Such a community must have the basic equipment of adequate libraries, lecture rooms, laboratories, common rooms, and residences. But it must also have a membership that is, for the most part, and during its student days, totally immersed in university life. This does not, of course, mean that the university community should be cut off from the larger community. On the contrary, the university community normally flourishes better within a larger community that is itself interested in matters of the mind and spirit, which understands and respects the work of the university, and which both gives and takes stimulation to and from it. This does imply, however, that that university study is a full-time occupation, and that well-qualified students should be encouraged by a national system of scholarships, bursaries, and loans to obtain their university education and professional qualifications in a full-time student capacity if they can possibly do so. There are individuals for whom the role of full-time student is not possible, and the university should make provision for such persons. But a university can only do its teaching and research effectively and plan its programs of study efficiently and use its physical facilities economically if the vast majority of its members are in a full-time capacity. Likewise, the university teaching staff can only be effective at both teaching and research if the universities are sufficiently well-staffed so that research can be carried on without limiting the attention that is given to students, and so that teaching can be vitalized by original investigation. It is equally important that the teaching members of university be paid at a rate that will enable them to give themselves over fully to their scholarly and teaching duties, and which will attract and keep in the profession persons with the power to instruct, to stimulate, and to contribute to knowledge. There's one other function of the contemporary university community which needs special comment. We have referred to the responsibility of the university to be a center of original research and speculative thought, to serve the community by supplying the educated and professionally trained graduates society requires. But it is also the responsibility to channel the fruits of its investigation and thought, and the thought and research of others, to the informed public at large. This has been an accepted function of the university's adult education activities. But in particular, in a world in which change has become constant, the universities, through their adult education departments, have been called upon to provide opportunities for the periodic refreshment and upgrading of those who want to keep abreast of scientific and social change in their fields of special interest. Medicine, agriculture, engineering, and technology have in particular all felt urgent need of this type of academic refreshment to avoid obsolescence. University extension work is of special significance in a rapidly developing society which must keep itself abreast of change if it is to have the qualified personnel it requires to direct its own development. Universities in the British tradition of higher education in the 20th century have been at pains to distinguish clearly between their service to society and their relation to the state. They have had to, as the state has moved into larger and larger areas of social and economic activity, and as the universities have become more and more dependent on state support. Fortunately, the state, in the British tradition, has been equally conscious of the value of the universities to society and of the need to provide support for the universities without imposing state controls. That this has been achieved is a remarkable tribute to the political wisdom and experience of the United Kingdom, where it was early recognized that as the power and authority of the state increased, the traditional responsibility of the universities to maintain themselves as centers of independent thought must also increase. To give effect to this desirable end, the device of the University Grants Committee was developed to ensure adequate financing of universities without state control. The universities, and here's a particular point that I've been leading up to because it has particular relevance in our society, in my opinion, not only New Zealand society. The universities in this tradition have complementary responsibilities to those of the state. Just as the state has the responsibility of supporting, without controlling, the universities in the interests of maintaining a free, flexible, and progressive society, so the universities have the responsibility of interpreting their service to society in such a way that, of their own volition, they meet the legitimate needs of that society. We've heard a great many representations about the needs of the community and about how best to meet them from government departments and agencies, from voluntary organizations, and from the University of New Zealand and its constituent universities and colleges. Our attention has in particular been drawn to the difficulty which will be experienced in interpreting legitimate national needs to the separate universities and colleges. We recognize this as the most important consideration, and it will be dealt with in the chapter in this report dealing with the process of devolution. Here it is sufficient to note that national machinery must be provided for the due consideration of legitimate social needs, and that the universities must be sensitive to meeting them, but that decisions about how to best to meet educational needs are educational decisions to be made by the universities and not by potential employers or government. Without this power of decision in the hands of universities and the National University Authority, the universities cannot become effective in the management of their own affairs, nor efficient in meeting community needs in appropriate university terms. The universities in the past have, in our opinion, not been responsible enough to some legitimate needs, particularly in some technological fields. But in other respects, notably in their willingness to arrange lecture schedules to suit the convenience of part-time students at the expense of full-time students, they have been too responsive to the detriment of the education they have been able to provide. Those most interested have every right to press the universities to meet their needs. The universities have an obligation to consider these needs and to do all they can to meet them. What they must not do is to give the appearance of meeting the expressed need by offering a form of instruction that will not really meet it. Unless the universities are equally responsible in studying the developing needs of the society of which they are a part, and serving the growing points and emerging professional activities with research into ideas or techniques, and when justified, offering courses of study for degrees or diploma courses by way of university extension programs. In this process of selection, the universities cannot afford to neglect traditional learning for contemporary need, but it is equally important that they do not neglect the legitimate requirements of their own society's development in their absorption with the cultures of former times or other lands. Now that, I think, covers the point in particular I wanted to make tonight, because it seems to me that higher education, not only in New Zealand, but just as much and to the same extent in Canada, is being caught between the pressures for equality of social opportunity through education, on the one hand, which, unless we have well-qualified teachers in sufficient numbers in schools, will have and will continue to have a depressing effect on educational standards. It's caught on the side of social egalitarian demand, with which I fully and wholeheartedly sympathize. And on the other hand, its responsibility for providing social leadership through original investigation and the transmission of the cultures of our own and other lands. Now, I've said enough. I'm going to conclude by reading a short poem by a New Zealand poet whom I got to know and like very much, by the name of Dennis Glover. First time I met Dennis, we had lunch together. Lunch to Dennis was 12 beers. I contained 6, and that was all I could rise to. He is typically New Zealand. No, he's more and better than typically New Zealand, but there's this tendency. And Dennis here expresses something that pleased me very much in New Zealand, that is the emergence of an egalitarian national self-consciousness. And I have to explain, before you get to the punchline of this poem, that I read this and didn't mean much to me until I visited two little towns in New Zealand. One's a suburb of Wellington called Johnsonville. And Johnsonville is about as drab a little suburb of small shops you ever saw. And Geraldine, which is a sort of half ghost town, former mining. And Canada's full of them. And Dennis is singing here Home Thoughts. In Windsor Castle lives the king. No doubt it is a pleasant thing to sing of Windsor and the king. But if I sing of anything, I much prefer to sing of where the tram cars clang across the square, or where above the little bay John Robert Godley passed his day, or where the brooding hills reveal the sunset of a living wheel. I think, too, of the bridal track, where first they saw the plains curve back to Alps, of how that little band of pilgrims viewed their promised land. For I am glad when new lands yield their stubborn crust to living field, and when the road goes scarring back through silence to a mountain shack where blankets, candles, frying pan bespeak the only needs of man. I do not dream of Sussex Downs or quaint old England's quaint old towns. I think of what will yet be seen in Johnsonville and Geraldine.
Mr. Darling, to express the thanks of our audience to Dean Andrew.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. We've got this apparatus up. You may as well use it. Go ahead.
I wasn't sure whether I could make myself heard over here, so I'll come here. Can everybody hear me? Am I talking loud enough? Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Dean Andrew, ladies and gentlemen, when Mr. Nemetz finished his introduction to Dean Andrew, I saw him turn around in a sort of contemplative way in my direction, and it suddenly occurred to me that I was sitting in the seat that Dean Andrew was sitting in 2 weeks ago when he introduced Vice Principal David Thompson. I don't know whether this is the seat of honor, but if Sonny's in a rut, then you know where not to sit. Actually, of course, I am delighted to be here to thank Dean Andrew. Too often, I think, Dean Andrew, we hear from you in terms of thanking somebody rather than telling us something. And it was a delight to me tonight to hear Dean Andrew telling me something that I didn't already know. Dean Andrew often reminds me of what was once described to me as a capable executive, was a man who saw all, heard all, and told nothing. Tonight he stepped out of the administrative role and into the one of the professor, which I was very glad to hear our chairman introduce him as, and gave us a very interesting evening. When Dean Andrew was introduced or thanking Vice Principal Thompson, he said, ladies and gentlemen, we have heard tonight, and I love these phrases, they just roll out of Jeff like nothing, we have had a feast of reason. And I tried to think tonight as I was waiting for my call of some suitable metaphor that I could describe Dean Andrews. The only thing I could think of was a symphony of thought, and I didn't think that was too good. He really isn't symphonic. I think probably he's a lone wolf, and perhaps an etude would be better. I think that it is important that we hear something of education other than that of Russia. And certainly, I don't think there's any subject that interests, has more common interest than education today. Dean Andrew, your expose of that New Zealand, its people, its social life, its beer drinking habits, and its educational problems has been most interesting and most thought provoking, and I'm sure we have all had a very wonderful evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, the reason I'm not sitting tonight is that the broadcasters have preempted my chair.
other than the than Mr. Darling and some of us here have appreciated some of the lectures, and they are being taped for rebroadcast at a later date. So I thought some of you who might have been watching this machine going would like to know why it was going. Now, just before I conclude the meeting, I should point out that in choosing Dean Andrew, in his as a well-known advocate of excellence in all things, pointed out quite rightly tonight that sometimes the chairman has a more difficult time in introducing a close friend than he does a stranger. And second of all, he did point out, I think quite rightly, that the title was not the title that he suggested. Now, I should tell the members of the Institute that this question of title achievement is one of the more difficult tasks that I didn't know about until I undertook the job of chairman of this Institute. Apparently, there's a constant warfare that goes on between an organization and the speaker as to what his title is going to be. The object, it seems, on the part of the organization is to get a title after they get a general idea of what they're asking the speaker to speak about, and have a title, our press officer tells us, which will attract the attention of the layman to come to the, being relatively modest English, and to attract him to come to a lecture. The object apparently of the speaker, many speakers, not our speaker tonight, of course, is apparently to make the subject, the title of his subject, so erudite and so abstruse and so recondite that it will reach a certain level of his own colleagues and reach a new height of covering the subject with such an enclosure of generality that he will be able to avoid the subject that the Institute has asked him to speak on. I'm very glad, therefore, to tell my distinguished colleague that tonight, of course, he kept directly on his subject, despite the press officer's enthusiasm, which he should not have taken out on such an old hand of the game as Dean Andrew. Our next speaker, ladies and gentlemen, is another distinguished person in the field of teaching of English, a distinguished principal of Victoria College at Toronto University. He was for many years a teacher there, and now is an administrator as well. He is Dr. Northrop Frye. His subject will be, have we become illiterate? And may I, just before I close the meeting, explain further that when we wrote him...
Who chose the title?
We... Dean Andrew and I did not rehearse this, but I'm going to answer that question. We thought that his title should be, and it shows you how this turns and this fight occurs. We asked him to speak on the subject, are we becoming illiterate? And he answered back, have we become illiterate? So I think this will be of great interest to you, I'm sure. And until 8:15 then, good evening.